This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While neither France nor Russia has used the word veto, both now say they will vote against the Anglo-American resolution on Iraq when it comes to a vote in the Security Council, perhaps as soon as tomorrow. Over the weekend, French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin flew to Africa to lobby undecided members. Today, President Bush is reported to be working the phones. Secretary of State Powell told the Sunday talk shows that he still hopes for a two-thirds majority on the council, but would not be surprised by a veto. This afternoon, Pakistan announced that it will abstain in the vote, which makes 9 votes for a two-thirds majority very unlikely. Last week, the president made it clear that whatever happens at the United Nations, war can only be averted by an immediate decision to disarm by Iraq or by an abdication by Saddam Hussein. With an American-led attack possible within a week, today we begin a series of discussions with people who've been thinking and talking about the vital issues, and today we'll focus on the immediate and longer-term importance of alliances and on the risks for the United States and for the UN. In a moment, writer Robert Kagan joins us from Brussels. We'll also talk with John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago. Later in the program, we'll look at the history of vetoes and high-risk politics in the Security Council, and we want to hear from you. Where is the burden now? On Iraq to come clean before it's too late? If the United States and Britain agree to move the deadline a week or two, would that make a difference? With divisions deepening, what's the effect on a possible war, on post-war reconstruction, on America's alliances, and on the Security Council? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his office in Brussels, Belgium, is Robert Kagan, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of Paradise and Power, America versus Europe in the New World Order. And Robert, it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
You've argued that it's important for the United States to take action in Iraq with or without allies. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I don't know about with or without allies. I think we're certainly going to have allies with us. I do think that we can't necessarily count on the UN Security Council making the right decision in this case. And yes, I do believe that. I think that Saddam is a sufficient threat to both our security and to global security for us to take the necessary action.
What would the consequences be if the U.S., if it comes to a vote in the Security Council and either there's no majority or there's a veto and the U.S. decides and its allies decide to go ahead anyway?
Well, obviously we are in a situation that we'd rather not be in with so many sort of publics and many governments against us on this. I do think, however, we need to put the UN Security Council issue in some historical perspective. We all remember that for more than 40 years during the Cold War, no one ever thought of taking any major issue to the Security Council because there was a Soviet veto there. And the Europeans also didn't think that the only legitimacy for action during those years came from the Security Council. So it's really only fairly recently that anyone has thought that it's even possible to go to the Security Council. And again, 4 years ago, when Europeans and Americans went to war in Kosovo, there was no UN Security Council resolution. So it's not as if this is actually a new situation that we're moving into.
But what does it say about the strength of the American position or perhaps the persuasiveness of American diplomacy when the United States can't easily bring along allies such as Canada and Mexico?
Well, it says one of two things. Either the United States has made its case poorly, or, for a variety of reasons, other countries just can't see the logic of the argument. Now, I can't speak about Mexico and Canada, but I can say that as far as Europe is concerned, where I do a lot of traveling, one of the problems is, I think, that Europeans didn't experience September 11th. And for them, Iraq is an enormous leap, and they don't really see a connection that I know many Americans also don't see, but I would think a majority of Americans do see between the risk posed by weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein and international terrorism.
What do you see as the connection with 9/11? And the president was talking about that repeatedly in his news conference the other night. At least according to the polls, many Americans are still unpersuaded.
Well, I myself have been in favor of removing Saddam Hussein from power for more than 7 years now. So for me, it isn't September 11th per se. I do think that Americans should be worried, and many are, that Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, his chemical and biological weapons, could fall into the hands of those who might, in fact, use them against us or against our allies. But for me, the threat has always been Saddam's risk to the region. He's invaded two countries in the region already. He's used weapons of mass destruction. And I believe he intends to do both aggressions and the use of those weapons in the future. And it's not going to get easier to stop him. So I've always felt that it was very important to take him out of power in Iraq, both for regional security and our security.
What do you make of the president's argument now? Other people have made it before. He articulated it, I guess, most expansively in an address to the Heritage Foundation a couple of weeks ago, or perhaps it was the American Enterprise Institute. I get them confused sometimes. But it was when he talked about the importance of a democracy in the region, using Iraq as an engine of reform.
Well, I do think that if we are going to intervene in Iraq, we should not reinstall a dictatorship there when we leave. And I think that we should have the goal of building a democracy in Iraq, understanding that it's going to be a difficult process. I think if we do undertake that effort, it will inevitably have some effects on the rest of the region. And I guess I'm not thrilled with decades-long American policy of supporting dictators in that part of the world, when in places like Latin America and Asia, we've actually taken a more enlightened view and tried to support democracy. I don't think that the Arab and Muslim peoples are uniquely among the entire human race incapable of democracy. So, of course, we should be pushing for it with realism.
Do you agree that if there is a successful conclusion to a war, and perhaps more in doubt, a successful conclusion to the peace, that at that point the United States could get its troops out of Saudi Arabia and perhaps not be so much in bed with the sheikdoms of the Gulf?
Well, I mean, that might be one consequence. I have to say that, from where I sit, the number one objective is dealing with Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. There are many other things that we can and should do in the region, but right now that is the primary objective. Just as in previous wars, say World War II, the primary objective was defeating Japan and Germany, and then there were both opportunities and dangers that came after that.
Mm-hmm. So don't get too far ahead of yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, we should have the appropriate ultimate objectives, but let's deal with first things first.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address again, TOTN@NPR.org. And Robert joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When Colin Powell talks about all these other countries going along with us, I'm not too sure I understand that, because there's no hard numbers that talk about how many of their troops, how much money is going to come from these other countries. And to me, it almost seems as though he's picking and choosing all these countries that are possibly afraid to not agree with us. And so they're just agreeing with us just to say they agree with us.
Well, to be fair to Secretary Powell, I think he was talking about support at the United Nations and speeches. But Robert Kagan, so far Britain and Australia are the only countries that would be providing troops.
Well, this gets to a deeper point, and it sort of relates to the point that you initially raised, in terms of what is the consequence for the United States of not having a great number of allies necessarily participating with us? And in one very practical sense, the caller is exactly right, that even if we had every ally in Europe on board for this, the United States would still be providing 95% of the military forces for this action, for the simple reason that, for better or for worse, Europe has not provided itself with a great deal of military capacity.
As the U.S. did in Kosovo, for example.
As the U.S. did in Kosovo, as the U.S. did in the Persian Gulf War. And this is one of the realities of the present era, is that the United States has much, much more military power at its disposal, and Europeans are left with the unpleasant option of agreeing to operations and then maybe helping afterwards, but they really don't have much to contribute in an actual military operation right now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Robert. One country that did come out and support the United States in the past couple of days was Japan. Again, not seen as in any way a military ally, but an important donor of international aid, a country that could be important after the war.
That's right, and I also think significant in one other respect. I mean, one of the things that I think is differentiating Americans from many Europeans is the European sense that there really are no threats out there. I mean, because Europe is a continent that has rid itself of war. Japan, on the other hand, lives in a much more dangerous neighborhood. They have North Korea to worry about. They have China to worry about. It's an unstable world out there. I think they have a better sense of the risks of the world, and that's why they throw their weight in with the United States.
If this is an American-led attack without the imprimatur of the Security Council, and even if they somehow do get France and Russia to abstain and get the 9 votes, it's going to be seen as an American-led attack in any case. It doesn't that, you know, isn't one of the ideas of the Security Council and the idea of collective security to sort of spread the risk around? And in this case, it's going to be seen as Bush's war, isn't it?
Yes, but again, I just think that, you know, the ideal of what the UN Security Council could be and what the reality of what the UN Security Council has been are two very different things. And during the Cold War, it was fundamentally American power. After the Cold War, as you said, in Kosovo, it has been fundamentally American power. And we can't expect to be able to spread the risk and the burdens if no one is really capable of shouldering those burdens.
Let's go now to Shahryar, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who's on the line with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Yes, sir, that you pronounced it correctly. I'm a veteran of the first Gulf War, what we call the first Gulf War, Iran-Iraq War, and I'm an immigrant from Iran.
The real first Gulf War.
The real first Gulf War, right.
Yeah. As most people who are listening to this program know, the first Gulf War was a very bloody and fruitless war, and about 1.2 million people died between the two sides, mostly Iranians. And the first thing I wanted to say was a question for you, sir. Do you think we're going to use the same, U.S., because I'm a U.S. citizen, I consider myself an American, so do you think we're going to use the same tactics that we used in Afghanistan, which I think is the proper way to go in Iraq? And what do you think about what I call the U.S. forgetting about the tail end of a project? We go in, dislodge something, do a good thing, then we forget about it, then it brews into something else like it happened in Afghanistan.
And some say it's happening again in Afghanistan. Robert Kagan?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, the second point is that if the United States is going to undertake this task, it has a very serious responsibility, both to itself, I think, but also to the Europeans and the countries of the Persian Gulf and the Middle East, to take the responsibility after the war seriously and to stay as long as necessary to maintain stability and build something better after Saddam. So I think that's exactly right. I do think it's, I'm glad you brought up the, as you correctly call, the first Gulf War, because I do think that people forget that that was another war that Saddam Hussein initiated. He provoked that war, and he used weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, against the Iranian people, both military and civilian.
Yes, and to remind the listeners, if they know this at all, most of those weapons purchased from Germany, France, China, and Russia. And it's no coincidence that those countries are against it, because today France has trillions of dollars of deals made with Iraq that will be paid in spare parts of their weapons programs. Al-Samud is nothing more than an SA-2 missile, a SAM-2 missile that is modified to take a warhead, and SAM-2s were made by Russians. So it's a bit of a hypocritical position by the French, and I lived in France for 5 years. I really felt racism when I lived there. It's very hypocritical by the French to talk about war and unilateralism while right now, as we speak, they have their French Foreign Legion in the country of Ivory Coast, Chad, and a couple of other countries in Africa without any permission from the United Nations, without any talk about, oh, can we do this together or any of that. So it's very hypocritical in my position. The other comment I had...
Shahryar, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop it there because
we're running
out of time, but just to note, there are plenty of ironies to go around, but thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
We'll be back after a short break with more with Robert Kagan and more of your phone calls. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Again, you can also send us email, TOTN, at npr.org. And a few minutes later, we'll also be joined by John Mearsheimer, a professor at the University of Chicago. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When we face turning points, we often seek guidance from the wisdom of others. During one of our discussions on the air about the possibility of war with Iraq, we received a listener email quoting these words from President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address in 1961. Quote, "Down the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certain agony of the battlefield." Martha Peach in Madrid, Spain, sent us that quotation. She says it sums up a portion of the motivation that has brought millions of people into the streets to protest the possibility of war with Iraq. Perhaps those words speak to you at this moment. Perhaps others frame the moment better. If so, we want to hear from you. What words offer you insight or maybe comfort as we face the possibility of war? Send us an email. We'll be reading some of your selections on the air throughout this next week. Please put the word quotation in the subject line, and if you wish, tell us why you chose the words you did. Also, make sure we can pronounce your name. Our email address again is totn@npr.org. Still on the line with us from Brussels, Belgium, is Robert Kagan, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His new book is Of Paradise and Power, America versus Europe in the New World Order. And let's take another call with him. Peter's on the line with us from Mill Valley in California.
Yes, I would just like to, before I ask my question, just make a point to reply to Robert Kagan. When he says the reason why the Europeans are so against the war, they one of the reasons may be that they didn't undergo the horror of September the 11th. I would remind him that actually the Europeans have been subjected to two world wars of the most appalling ferocity. France has been occupied and actually suffered three wars against Germany, and that the Europeans well understand the horrors of war, and what they have brought with them is a sophistication towards negotiating and understanding that armed conflict does not solve problems. Negotiation and sitting down and compromise does. My question is, what does he think will be the result of America going unilaterally to war, will be to its relationship with the United Nations, and in fact to the rest of the world? Does he think the United Nations has a future? Actually, it's been criticized that it won't do. And does he think that America will put itself beyond the pale and suffer as a result a reaction from the rest of the world and perhaps sanctions and boycotting and increasing isolation?
Well, just to repeat, the United States is not going to war alone. I mean, one of the countries that is going to war with the United States is going to be the United Kingdom, and there will be others involved in various ways as well. It's simply
Just interject there. In fact, the leaders do not represent the people, and this is one of the things I would point out about Powell's complete misrepresentation. Yes, you have the leaders of these countries saying, but they do not represent the people, and it's a complete falsehood to say that these countries are behind them. And I would posit that if war does happen, what you will see is an upswelling within the populace against the very governments, whether it's in Turkey, Italy, Spain, England, and so on.
Well, Peter, you asked a question. Let Robert Kagan answer.
I will.
Well, he's got a number of questions, and they're all good questions. I mean, first of all, I think it remains to be seen whether that's true. I think if the war is relatively successful and the peace is relatively successful, that's not what's going to happen at all in those countries. And I think that Tony Blair will, in fact, be strengthened. Now, the caller is quite right that public opinion in the European countries, including the UK and Spain and Italy, is against this war. On the other hand, public opinion was against American action in Kosovo and was against Bill Clinton when he wanted to do that. And yet, I think at the end of the day, American public opinion thought that that was probably worth doing. So it's quite right that they're opposed. But, you know, and the other thing is, finally, we can't make foreign policy in the world on the basis of an international poll. That's never been the way it's been possible to make foreign policy. Elected leaders, and in these cases they are all elected leaders, have to make these very hard decisions. That's what we elect them to do.
I would say there needs to be consensus more and more. And in fact, one of the things about globalization, the shrinking world, is that countries are having to learn how to interrelate and interreact. And there's a profound recognition globally right now that armed conflict does not solve problems. And in fact, one...
I must say I quite disagree with that, because in 1999, when all of Europe joined the United States in going to war in the internal affairs over the internal issues of another country, which happened at that time to be Serbia over Kosovo, there was no UN Security Council resolution, and they believed that war was precisely the right way to go. It simply isn't true that everyone agrees that there was no occasion when force must be used.
I'd like to thank Peter for his call. And Robert Kagan, I know you have to run. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Robert Kagan's book, Of Paradise and Power, America versus Europe in the New World Order. He's also a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was on the line with us from Brussels in Belgium. Joining us now is John Mearsheimer. He's the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, co-director of their program on international security policy. He joins us from the studio on the University of Chicago campus. And welcome back to you, sir.
Thank you, Neil.
You've said that containment has worked in the past, and most notably, of course, with the Soviet Union, can work in the future, even when dealing with Saddam Hussein. Is that still your view as we arrive at this moment?
Yes, I think there's no question that the United States has done an excellent job in the past containing its opponents, especially the Soviet Union during the Cold War. If the United States was able to contain the mighty Soviet Union, which at its peak had 40,000 nuclear weapons and was run by murderous thugs like Joe Stalin and Nikita Khrushchev, why couldn't it contain a nuclear-armed Saddam Hussein, who would never have that many nuclear weapons and would never have conventional forces that looked anything like the conventional forces that the Soviet Union had? Moreover, I would point out that the United States is basically accepting the fact that North Korea has nuclear weapons and plans to pursue a containment policy vis-a-vis North Korea. Well, if the United States plans to contain North Korea, why can't it contain Iraq?
Hasn't Saddam Hussein thumbed his nose at the United Nations these past 12 years?
He has thumbed his nose at the United Nations, but that's not a sufficient cause for war. The more important question is whether he can attack his neighbors and gain dominance in the region and threaten vital American interests. That's what we really care about. And we really are focused on the question of whether or not nuclear weapons would allow him to achieve those goals. And as I pointed out before, I think the United States could contain him, just as it contained the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There's no reason to think that he'd be able to thumb his nose at us. He may be able to thumb his nose at the United Nations. That's regrettable, but again, that's not a cause for war.
As a practical matter, how long can the United States keep those forces, the quarter of a million men and women there on the borders of Iraq, and especially after the President of the United States has said all the things that he said, is it possible for him to climb down now without a lot of bad effects there too?
I think it's almost impossible for him to climb down at this point. I think there are two reasons for that. One is that his rhetoric has painted him into a position where it's almost impossible for him not to go to war by the end of this month. If he agrees to continue inspections for a couple months, it would be a major blow to his prestige, especially among conservatives in this country. And I don't think he's going to allow that to happen. The second thing I would say, Neil, is that I think the economy is in bad shape, and there's all sorts of evidence that jitters about the geopolitical situation, especially the situation in Iraq, are fueling the troubles in the economy. And I think the Bush administration is anxious to get this one over with and put it behind us so that we can get back to working on the economy. So my bottom line is that it's very difficult to see how President Bush at this point in time can walk away from a war.
Let's get the callers back involved. Our next caller is Mick, who's on the line with us from Boston.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the call. I just want to go back to the issue of what's happening at the Security Council. And as I mentioned, I think that's missing from your discussion. I think the discussions that are there at present have very little to do with the issue of whether there should be a war in Iraq, because I think everybody accepts that that's an absolute foregone conclusion, that the US and the UK are going to war. I think what's happening there is a response to the fact that now we only have one superpower, and that the balance of the days of the two superpowers is missing. I think there is the beginnings of a realignment there, which if the U.S. isn't extremely careful, is going to end up being U.S. and its dominions versus the rest.
Hmm. John Mearsheimer, is France, for example, leaping in to provide a counterbalance against American power, or at least trying to?
Yeah, I think that the caller is probably correct that at this point in time, the French and the Russians and others understand that it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to slow down the American juggernaut. There's some small chance, maybe, that that will happen, and that could be motivating them. But I think that the caller is correct that what these states are mainly concerned with is the future. And I think they believe that if they give the United States a free hand this time, if they cave into American pressure this time, in no time the Americans will be back doing this again. It'll be either North Korea or Iran that they have in the crosshairs, and they'll be trying to push the Europeans and the Russians around again. So I think they believe that if they draw a line in the sand here and make the Americans pay a real price, that the Americans will be much less likely to behave in this unilateral kind of fashion down the road, and that'll be to their advantage.
Or much less likely to come back to the United Nations Security Council.
Yes, I think that's for sure. But the problem that the United States faces is that if you're going to try and run the world, which of course the Bush administration is interested in doing, it's very difficult to do that unilaterally. You really have to do it multilaterally. If you think about North Korea, there's no way we're going to solve that problem unilaterally. If you think about what's going on in Iran now, we're going to need the cooperation of the Russians and maybe even the United Nations to do everything we can to slow down Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons. If you think about Iraq, not so much conquering Iraq, but occupying it and rebuilding it, it would be much to the Americans' advantage if they could get help from the United Nations. Doing the occupation unilaterally is a really bad thing. So the point I would make is that if you have an ambitious agenda, and the Bush administration certainly does, multilateralism is much preferable to unilateralism.
Mm. Mick?
I won't add anything. I completely agree.
Well, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Now let's go to Brian, and he's in Platte, South Dakota.
Hello there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first thing I have to say is just a minor comment on the previous speaker that said something about, you know, some of these missiles and weapons are actually coming from France, Germany, and Russia.
I think he said these were before the Gulf War, that Iraq's arsenal was largely purchased from France, Russia, China, and Germany.
Yep, and then he had some comments about maybe some interest in supplying parts. I think if we had this kind of information, you know, pertaining to actual weapons that Saddam has, I think there'd be a lot more, I guess, support from the public. And then I do have a question on containment. How do you contain an organization or a faction like terrorists that have no moral compunctions that maybe a nation might have? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. John Mearsheimer?
Two very quick points on Brian's comments. First of all, it's important to note that in the 1980s, when Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against the Iranians and against the Kurds, the United States was helping him in that endeavor. In particular, we were providing him with overhead satellite intelligence so that he could employ those chemical weapons smartly. And then we were providing him diplomatic protection, both in the United States and in the United Nations, when various actors who were horrified by what he was doing tried to bring that to the world's attention, the United States government, specifically the Bush administration and the Reagan administration, that's the first Bush administration, mm-hmm. went to some lengths to protect Saddam. Secondly, on containment, it's very important to emphasize that containing Saddam is not the same as containing terrorism. Or containing al-Qaeda. The fact of the matter is that al-Qaeda cannot be contained. The United States has to seek out and destroy al-Qaeda because it is undeterrable. The fact of the matter is that because terrorists have no return address, you can't threaten to retaliate against them the way you can against states, and therefore they're almost impossible to deter. So we have to go to great lengths to make sure that al-Qaeda doesn't get nuclear weapons, and then eventually finish them off. Saddam's a very different story. Saddam, like the Soviet Union during the Cold War and like North Korea, can be contained. He's not that aggressive, and even with nuclear weapons, there's no reason that we couldn't keep him in his box.
John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to David, who's on the line with us from San Francisco.
Hi there, Neil. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And first off, I guess I would say that I agree completely with all the statements that John Mearsheimer has made. I think that's actually one of the clearest layouts of a lot of the situation that we have over here, over there, that I've heard. The other thing, I guess, just sort of a statement, is that it seems to me that a lot of the people that are running this administration that have a global plan, the Chicken Hawk Group, as they're known, are also some of the people who have most wanted to undermine the United Nations. So they're certainly in a situation right now where they seem to be attempting to undermine the relevance or the credibility or the value of the Security Council by going against any of the countries that are against us. And even though France and others may have their own reasons, but they're still in a position that they can credibly say, we don't believe in this war, and we're going to cast a veto. And I guess the question that I have is that as the United States pushes this idea, and I haven't yet heard anything that Colin Powell or any of the others have made that's an argument for a significant threat from Iraq, and I've heard many, many things where they've been false, like this forged
document. Quickly, David.
Have they, in a situation, why aren't they talking about the number of Israeli violations of UN Security Council when they've had three or four times as many as the Iraqis?
Okay. John Mearsheimer?
Well, 2 points. One is, with regard to the Israelis, I think that's a separate issue from the Iraq issue, and I think it's very important just to focus on the Iraq issue at this point in time. I think in another context, one can talk about how to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but I think it behooves us at this point in time to focus our attention on the subject of Iraq. With regard
to the situation where, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but where it comes together, and I think it's even less about, I mean, there is a whole Israeli-Iraq issue, Arab issue, which relates to our relationship to the Arab and Muslim world, but the fact of the United States being so hypocritical that on one hand we have vetoed and
David, you're going to have to make it very fast.
Okay, that we've opposed all these resolutions against Israel and are not calling for sanctions against them. At the same time, we're calling for sanctions against Iraq.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to, David, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. And Professor Mearsheimer, I'm afraid David has used the last of your time, but we appreciate you coming in to speak with us today. We know you have
My
to go,
pleasure.
And it's always good to speak with you. John Mearsheimer, the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor and co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He was with us from the campus. When we come back, inside the UN Security Council, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow we ask the question, who will fight this war? As the country braces for a possible conflict, we want to hear from the men and women who make up our military, whether they're on the front or behind a computer or maybe behind the wheel of a truck. Call us. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about the coming vote on Iraq by the United Nations Security Council, an unprecedented moment for this council. Sure, there's been wrangling over votes before. Lots of vetoes have been cast. This type of down-to-the-wire suspense is unique, perhaps. Joining us now to talk about the history of the Security Council and where it goes from here is Thomas Weiss. He's director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies, where he directs the United Nations Intellectual History Project. He's with us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
We do know that this is a critical moment for the Council, obviously. Is it unique? Has this never happened before where the United States has introduced backed an important resolution like this without knowing the outcome?
Well, one normally goes to the Security Council knowing the outcome, either positively or negatively. it's quite unusual to not know the outcome of 9 of 15 votes. Normally, one tries to get as many as possible, and in my courses, I try to explain the mathematics of getting 9 votes with all of the permanent members concurring or at least abstaining. And we've never ever had to use this mathematics before. Normally, the votes are much higher. Rarely are they at all contested, and certainly not on important issues.
In the early days of the United Nations, it seemed like the United States would often bring up resolutions knowing that they would be vetoed by the Soviet Union.
That's correct. And over time, for instance, just a few years ago, China vetoed one on the continuation of the force in Guatemala because it had a dispute over Taiwan. But these have always been an opportunity to isolate a single or sometimes two members of the Security Council to try to embarrass them, not to hope that they would stand aside and we would somehow cobble together 9 votes.
And that's turned around on the United States on issues including Israel and in the past, South Africa.
Absolutely. In the past, both with apartheid in South Africa during much of the 70s and 80s, the tactic of the rest of the world was to try to show how isolated the United States and Britain were in relationship to disinvestment in South Africa. And in the Mideast, the United States has frequently been the only country voting against a resolution on Israel. And there the tactics were to try to show how far out of line a single country was, because the result was the same. The resolution was turned down. You may recall in 1999 the resolution that did not go to the Security Council on Kosovo. Everyone assumed that China and Russia would veto that resolution, and therefore, rather than having two countries veto it, which is a substantial negative vote, more substantial than a single one, the NATO decided to go ahead and not bring the resolution to the Security Council because it would have complicated decision-making in many NATO countries to have a negative vote from the Security Council. No vote was better than a negative vote. And so this time, the mathematics as well as the politics are very different.
Just to remind listeners, there are always 15 members of the Security Council. 5 are permanent: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China. If they vote no on anything, that's it. It doesn't pass. There are also 10 elected members of the Council. And Thomas Weiss, there have been proposals from time to time about expanding the number of people on the Council or doing away with the veto of the permanent members.
That's correct. Actually, the only constitutional change, so to speak, in the UN Charter, which is its constitution, that has occurred as concerns the Security Council in 1965. We moved from 11 to 15 members. And in around the UN's anniversary in 1995, that is the 50th anniversary, at the height of the fervor about the Cold War era being something new, a lot of proposals were made to expand the Council. The last time it was expanded in the mid-1960s, 65, to reflect a large number of new countries. This time the notion was to expand it not only because there were still more countries, but also because the balance of power in the year 1995, or the year 2003, is considerably different from the one that we had in 1945 when the 5 permanent members were nominated. There is that proposition has been discussed since 1995. We have moved nowhere. It's fairly easy to understand that when you have to have the people with vetoes agree to give them up, and they can veto such a proposition, that that notion is not going to go very far.
Well, joining us now to talk about how these decisions actually look like from the inside is Noel Doerr, who was Ireland's representative on the UN Security Council in 1981 and 1982. He joins us from his home in Dublin, Ireland. He's been good enough to speak with us before in this program. Ambassador Doerr, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
When you were on the Security Council, I wonder, did you ever come under the kind of lobbying effort that we hear that the United States and France are engaged in right now?
No, I don't think it was ever quite as strong as that. We did have a difficult time at that stage because the Falklands issue came up in the Security Council. And while the Irish government supported the initial resolution calling on Argentina to withdraw from its seizure of the Falklands in March of 1982, there was a different position taken in May as the war was about to begin, and the Irish government sought to raise the issue at that time in the council with a view to getting further mediation by the Secretary General to try to head off the war, which was imminent. That was a difficult time for us in the council. But no, I don't think that there's been a previous example of the kind of situation we have today.
I'm sure you've read reports about the kind of, let's not put too fine a point on it, arm twisting that's going on. Is that inappropriate?
Well, I think that's the way the world works. Countries act in accordance with their interests. They also perhaps have some higher motives at times, and you cannot expect them to ignore their interests. And obviously, in a situation like this, various means will be used by both sides in the argument to both persuade and induce and cajole countries to vote in a particular way. I think that's the way the world is. Behind it, however, is the basic idea of the United Nations as an international system of legitimacy, which is now accepted by all of the world, a world divided into nearly 200 sovereign states. And the fact that the Charter is universally accepted, even if not universally upheld, perhaps, is an important development in international life. I think it's the first time we've had that kind of international system of legitimacy. Of course, it's imperfect. In many ways it is, and states will act within it in accordance with their interests. But nevertheless, I think it's important to uphold it.
If you have a question, by the way, about this process, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email totn@npr.org. And Mr. Weiss, just wanted to ask you just what Noel Doerr was talking about. I think since the creation of the United Nations, every single member of the Security Council, every single permanent member of the Security Council, has used force without the authorization of the Council.
Absolutely. And this has been what's the real change in the present era is that we sometimes ask for permission to use force, not just use it on our own. And that reflects the change in politics in the post-Cold War era. And it also reflects the fact that you can actually do more of certain kinds of things when you have this blessing than when you do not.
We have an email here from Grant, and it doesn't say where he's from. What is the purpose of a UN resolution if it doesn't mean anything, he writes. In my opinion, if a UN resolution is to be an effective tool in bringing out some desired change, the resolution must be credible, must be backed up by consequences at some point. 10+ years and 16 or 17 resolutions seem to be a timetable that's reaching its upper limit of acceptability. Noel Doerr, you're...
Could I just comment on that? Remember that... It is on the basis of Security Council resolutions enacted since 1990 that sanctions have been imposed on Iraq, quite severe sanctions. It is also on the basis of those resolutions that a very intrusive inspection regime has been imposed on Iraq. Iraq has been forced to accept the kind of intrusive inspection that no other country has ever had to accept in regard to disarmament and so on. That is an enforcement by the Council of its decisions. So there has been enforcement of Security Council resolutions. In fact, I think the present dispute is whether to give more time to those inspections or not. But I do not think it's quite right to say that Security Council resolutions are toothless. They have been and can be effective, and they have, in fact, provided the basis for a very, very severe sanctions regime on Iraq and for this very intrusive inspection, which is going on as we speak.
We're talking with Noel Doerr, who was Ireland's ambassador to the United Nations and served as its representative on the UN Security Council back in the early 1980s, and with Thomas Weiss, who's co-director of the UN Intellectual History Project, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Thomas Weiss, I think this one goes to you. It's an email question from Mark in Palo Alto. How did France and China get their permanent seats? Neither, he writes, were world powers when they were given their seats, like the U.S., the U.K., and the USSR.
That was the politics at the end of the Second World War. In fact, the seat at that time was occupied by the nationalists who held power, and they maintained that seat until 1971, largely at Western insistence. So this is not
the
first time.
Republic of China, what we now generally refer to as Taiwan.
Taiwan, that's right.
If I may intervene here, that the United Nations was planned during the war by the major allies, and in fact the blueprint for it was drawn up at a conference in Dumbarton Oaks in Washington in late 1944. And it was largely the United States, the United Kingdom, and at that time Soviet Russia, but they brought in China and later France, because these were the major allied powers at the end of the Second World War. It is interesting, perhaps, to note that these countries were at war at the time, in a kind of total war. So we must assume that they were serious when they planned the UN. In other words, it wasn't just a high-minded ideal. It was something that leaders like Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin at least hoped would work in the peace and would regulate the world after the war was over. But they planned for it as early as 1942-43, and the major plan was drawn up in 1944 in Washington.
And given France's historical role and the fact that they had a large colonial empire, it seemed that at the time that they would continue to play a major role on the world scene. So it was logical, even though the questioner is perfectly correct, that France hadn't played a very large role in the victory of the Second World War, and the Chinese seat was occupied by a puppet of sorts.
You could say that the United Nations was really a continuation of the wartime alliance into the peace, because the basis for the initial membership of 50 or 51 states in the UN was that all of them were at least nominally at war with Germany or Japan in March 1945, and they were the founder members of the UN. So the underlying idea was that the alliance in the war would continue into the peace. What has happened since then is that the United Nations has grown into a universal organization of states. As the state system has expanded, we now have 191 members in the UN instead of the initial 51, and it has become the first universally accepted system of legitimacy for states in history, just at the time when the world has organized itself as a world of sovereign states, with the end of colonialism and empires in the past. So that, I think, is important.
Patty Deek in Portland, Oregon, writes a question. I've heard these used interchangeably. She asks, are there four possible ways to vote in the Security Council? Yes, no, veto, and abstain? In other words, Tom Weiss, is it possible for a permanent member to vote no without casting a veto?
Well, actually, this is an interesting historical development. The charter is written that one wasn't supposed to be able to abstain. One was supposed to have to concur amongst the permanent five members. The language of the charter says that you must have a certain number of votes, in this case nine now, with concurring votes from the permanent members. Practice dictated that over the years an abstention was seen as a different kind of yes, or somewhere, at least not a no. So, in fact, the questioner is correct that you can vote yes. There are two different kinds of yeses and two noes, depending on whether you're
really
a permanent member or not.
There aren't really four options. I mean, what the term veto is simply a casual term used to describe a no vote by a permanent member.
So no mm-hmm. by a permanent member is
a veto.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The term is usually probably not used. If it is the no vote by a permanent member that blocks the decision, then it is customary to use the word veto.
So yeah, if
it failed for want of nine votes and a permanent member voted against among those who voted against, then probably by just custom they wouldn't use the word veto. But the reality is that there are three possible votes. There's a yes vote, a no vote, or an abstention. And if one of the five permanent members casts a no vote, that is, in ordinary language, a veto. So there's not a fourth position.
We will be exploring all these shadings of interpretation and language when the vote happens, perhaps as soon as tomorrow. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Noel Doerr, former ambassador to the UN for the Republic of Ireland, speaking with us from Dublin. And that was Thomas Weiss of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the City University of New York. He was with us from the studios of member station WRNI in Rhode Island. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.